Good morning. It's really lovely to be here with you all, and I'm happy to be alive. And today I'm going to talk about life and death in the Buddha's teaching. And right now I'm not afraid of death at all. I'm afraid of public speaking. So, thought I'd tell you that. Even though when my priest and teacher buddies listen to this later, they'll mark me off 5 points for saying that. So today I'm going to read from a number of sources. One is You Have to Say Something, Dainin Katagiri. And the other is from Jizo Bodhisattva by Chan, Chosen Bays. So, all right, stop being nervous. So let's start with the first two of the Four Noble Truths. This is from a book called The Feeling Buddha, and I think it's a paraphrase of his first teaching. The Noble Truth of Dukkha, Affliction, is this: birth, old age, sickness, death, grief, lamentation, pain, depression, and agitation are dukkha. Dukkha is being associated with what you do not like, being separated from what you do like, and not being able to get what you want. In short, the five aggregates of grasping are dukkha. This is the noble truth of affliction. This was the insight, understanding, wisdom, knowledge, and clarity which arose in me about things I had not been taught. This is the Buddha speaking. Affliction should be understood to be a noble truth. This was the insight, understanding, wisdom, knowledge, and clarity which arose in me about things I had not been taught. Full understanding of affliction as a noble truth has dawned. This was the insight, understanding, wisdom, knowledge, and clarity which arose in me about things I had not been taught. The noble truth of Samudaya, response to affliction, is this: it is thirst for self-recreation, which is associated with greed. It lights upon whatever pleasures are to be found here and there. It is thirst for sense pleasures, for being and non-being. And then he goes on in the same way as he did with the first one. The insight, the understanding, the wisdom, the knowledge, and the clarity which arose in me about things I had not been taught. So, sorry about my voice. This states the problem. Okay? This is the problem that we live with. And the one that I want to especially focus on is the problem of facing our death. Because it's Memorial Day, I thought I'd talk about this. And I also wanted to honor my teacher, my first teacher, Katagiri Roshi. Yesterday I was riding my bike by the cemetery, and I noticed how green the grass was there and how beautiful and fresh all the bouquets that people had brought for their loved ones looked. And that's just the way the world is. You know, there's beauty, jewel-like colors everywhere. It's a beautiful place. It's a place with the potential for great bliss and satisfaction, and also a place with the potential for great suffering. So, side by side with the affliction is this possibility for bliss that we have. But I can tell you from my own life that chasing after bliss and pushing away affliction really causes suffering. And the second noble truth points to that. You know, it states the problem. It's similar, I think, to the Serenity Prayer, in that it talks about, you know, having, you know, what we can change and what we cannot change. Some things happen to us, sickness, old age, and death happen to us, and we don't have any control over those things as much as we'd like to. We don't. So the second noble truth talks about our response to affliction, you know, our fear and our anxiety, our wish to either grasp at something to change it, or our wish for oblivion, or our tendency to turn away from it. Okay, so that's the problem. I think a lot of people think of the Buddha as he was a great figure, he was superhuman, he didn't have the kind of problems we have. He was born noble, he was born enlightened. Oftentimes people think that about the Buddha, but I don't think that's what life was really like for the Buddha. I think that because he was born into a noble family, a rich family, and he had everything given to him. His father, in fact, wanted to keep him completely satiated and satisfied, and he had everything a person could possibly want in the earthly realm. And I think that because of that, early on, he realized that that wasn't the answer. But he did suffer, and even after his enlightenment, he suffered. You know, his clan was annihilated after his enlightenment. His cousin plotted against him. His patron, King Bimbisara, was imprisoned and killed by his own son. And I think people brought their suffering to him, you know, their problems. So he must have been very sad at times. Because even though he was a great being, he was not beyond the feelings that we are prone to. So, similarly, I think that the death of the Buddha was probably the hardest thing that ever happened to his disciples. You can imagine being close to someone like that and having someone like that be gone from your world and the world in general. That would be hard. That would be the saddest thing that could ever happen. If you read the Sutra of the First Turning of the Wheel, and if you read Buddha's admonition, his sutra, his last sermon, you will find all of the Buddhist teachings in those two. Everything is there. So I recommend that. We don't often read those because we're a Zen center. This is Zen Buddhism and we're Mahayana, and those are Theravadan teachings. But there's a lot in those teachings that can really inspire you. So the truth, death is a mystery to us. And we really resist and deny death. We really, as a culture, maybe you don't, but maybe you're wise and enlightened, but the culture death that we live in. Death is feared, it's covered up, it's denied. And also impermanence is not liked very well either, you know. So, but every religion has a response to the problem of the fact that we don't live forever. You know, we have to die. We have to give up our very lives, our precious lives. And the response in Buddhism is basically to live this moment completely and thoroughly. Live this moment and the next moment and the moment after that with full devotion, with full mindfulness, as best you can. And to be kind to others, and to be kind to yourself. That's our response to death. We want everything to continue as it is. We don't want things to change. If we really wanted things to change, why would we get so stressed out when things change? At least when things change in ways that we didn't plan them to change, right? So that's the truth about us. We're hardwired that way. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, that's okay, but it's something that we have to cope with, that we have to work with. And the Buddhist path gives us lots of wonderful tools for that. So what are they? Sitting down in meditation every day, if possible. And watching. Talk about impermanence. You know, just watch your thoughts for 30 minutes. You know, they come up, stay for a little while, poof, they're gone. Thank goodness. They come up, stay a little while, and they're gone. And that can be a blessing. We fear impermanence, but it's also a blessing. For instance, when we're sitting in pain, or we're experiencing something that we know is temporary, but it's excruciating, then the truth of impermanence is our friend. So that's one of the practices that is available to us in this tradition. So here's what Dzogchen Rinpoche says about that. In our minds, change is always equal loss and suffering. And if they come, we try to anesthetize ourselves as far as possible. We assume stubbornly and unquestioningly that permanence provides security and impermanence does not. But in fact, impermanence is like some of the people we meet in life, difficult and disturbing at first, but on deeper acquaintance, far friendlier and less unnerving than we would have imagined. So, I like that. It's funny. And another funny thing. Some of you know that I have just finished an internship in chaplaincy. And so I've, confronted people on the edge of their deaths and been put in the position of being there for them in that circumstance. That's a great honor. And I've been very humbled and moved by that. But one of the things that my chaplaincy supervisor said when he presented to us on palliative care and end-of-life issues was that death is God's way of saying you need to slow down. So maybe it's a stretch to make jokes about death, but I have to find some way to lighten the subject up, right? So, let's see. Impermanence becomes our great ally when we can ask the question, if nothing lasts, everything changes, and I myself won't last, I myself have to die, then how shall I live? And what's really important in this life? And how shall I treat my friends? How shall I treat my enemies? How do I treat myself? My explorations in impermanence have basically just yielded those questions. But in a very real way, in a way that has penetrated my heart and has made an impact in my practice and in my life. Some of you know about the bodhisattvas. Probably a lot of you do. And I think the bodhisattva that I most resonate with is Jizo Bodhisattva or Kishtigarbha. And he's also called the Earth Storehouse Bodhisattva. And he's most well known for, he has shamanistic qualities. He enters into the most difficult of situations. He's the protector of children and women and babies who have died and the mothers of those babies who have died. And he's said to go into the hell realms. All the difficult realms, the hungry ghost realm and the fighting spirit realm and the hell realm, which consists of the cold hells and the hot hells. And, of course, those are psychological states that we can enter every single day, and maybe several times a day. But we can also enter the God realms and the human realm and the animal realm. So I relate to Jizo in my interest and my exploration in being present for people who are sick, people who are dying. And let's see, I have a reading for you from Jan Chosen Bay's book called No Fear. How is Kishtigarbha able to have no fear? We sometimes have bad dreams. Perhaps I have a dream that I've been shot in the leg. In the dream, I'm crying and afraid. I awaken and I'm no longer afraid. Why? A dream body can't be harmed. A dream cannot hurt the real body. The brief dream of our lives, even if nightmarish, cannot hurt the real body. Practices to cultivate no fear are the meditations on the five elements, on death, and on impermanence. Earth's store bodhisattva is unafraid because he knows that our fear is, like a dream, only a state of mind. What we are afraid will be harmed is a collection of five elements that will soon fall apart and return to the great earth body it emerged from. He's no more afraid of this than of the disappearance of a mirage or a play of shadows on moving water. Flux cannot hurt flux. Impermanence cannot hurt impermanence. So you might think, well, that's fine for Kishtagarbha, but I'm not there yet. And I'm here to say I'm not there yet either. But I think that the promise of Zen practice is that, you know, at first we sit down, we have a lot of thoughts, they just proliferate, and we think, oh, this isn't peace, this is agitation. But after a while in our practice, the thoughts, the proliferating thoughts calm down a bit. And then we begin to see our aggression and our other turbulent inner emotions, and we begin to work on pacifying them through just holding them in compassion over and over and over again. Pretty soon it's possible to experience pauses, just a complete stopping of thought. And then there's the possibility of connecting with pure awareness, just a luminous awareness, which actually is us and we are it. And that's present in life and it's present in death. And when we practice with that every day, using these wonderful tools of the Buddhist path, we begin to build our capacity to enter that place. And we can be there and bring that to the deathbed of a friend or loved one. It's a beautiful gift to offer. Where am I? Oh, okay. I've got some ideas here for how to work with impermanence and our personal death and the deaths of those we love. I think that these practices will build our capacity and our resilience to just face each moment, whatever the moment brings. Katagiri used to say, just stand up. Whatever life brings, just stand up there. And at first I thought, I'll never be able to do that. But I think over time I've learned a little bit how to do that, a little bit. So number one, these ideas are both mine and those of my friend Patrice Kelch. I don't know if any of you know her, but she's a teacher at Common Ground and she's a Buddhist chaplain. Number one, seek the truth. Study and put it into practice in your life, in your behavior. The truth of what? The truth of no self, the truth of impermanence, the truth of Nirvana. Two, define some standards and strive to live up to them. The Eightfold Noble Path is a set of standards. If you have difficulty finding a set, there's a lot of set of standards. Number three, seek to develop character because your character is your most enduring trait. Your character will take you all through life. Your personality, your money, lots of things won't take you very far, but you're building good character well, and the path, the Buddhist path, does that if you engage it. Four, practice letting go. Practice letting go on the cushion, where it's fairly, I feel anyway, it's not too risky to let go on the cushion. You're simply letting go of your thoughts. And your emotions, your reactions to your thoughts. It's harder to let go in a difficult situation in a relationship, but you should extend the letting go practice to relationship, you know, to control every minute of your existence. Those are things that I try to do anyway, because I really like to get my own way, and I really like to control every minute of my existence. Maybe you're more laid back than me. Penetrate the truth of impermanence. There's a lot of different ways to do that. You can do it on the cushion, you can do it with the seasons, you can make it a practice just to walk around in the fall and see how many things are passing away in front of your eyes. There's a number of ways to work with impermanence. Six, and I think most importantly, cultivate kindness. Diffuse your inner aggression and your difficult emotions. Pacify those through compassion if you're holding them gently, like a child. And then there's meditation and intention or vow. Now I want to say a little bit more about vow, because a lot of people new to Buddhism or Buddhist practice might find that a little strange or maybe a bit religious, vow. Basically, to me, to live in vow is to live with intention and to live in the big story of life. We all have a little story, and there's a lot of characters in it, and there's a lot of roles that we play, and then there's the chapter on when we were really messed up and addicted to drugs, and there's this other chapter where we were really a victim and being hurt by others, and there's so many chapters. There's all those chapters about what a great, wonderful person we are, and that's the small story, okay? So what living in vow or with spiritual intention does is to join us with the big story. Our little story becomes the big story that we live out together, all of us. That's the noble path, living out the big story. So I'll read to you a little bit about vow. She's the head teacher of a place called Great Vow Monastery in Oregon. The Earth Store Sutra tells of ordinary human beings becoming bodhisattvas through the power of their vows. My teachers talked often about the importance of making vows. It took me many years to understand that vows are at the core of practice, actually are the nuclear core of the energy pile that is our life. An interviewer once asked Maizumi Roshi, that was her teacher, Maizumi Roshi, if Buddhists believed in something like a soul that continued after death. Maizumi Roshi said, no, it's the vow that continues. A vow is like a seal that imprints itself on the wet clay of another emerging life, but it's more than a passive seal. It has a propelling energy. It propels us into the search for an end to suffering and into finding ways to help others. Finally, when all the various schemes we've developed to do those things fail, it propels us into practice. I'd like to end by saying a few things about Katagiri. I've noticed that in recent years, when I've been reading some of his writings, there's just been two books out of his talks. Now a third one is coming out soon. I'm really excited to read that. I had this idea of this memory of Katagiri that he was sort of like a spiritual Santa Claus. You know, he was just this great, warm, fuzzy guy who offered me unconditional regard and support, and was always there for me and mirrored great wisdom. But in reading some of his stuff, I'm remembering that he was full of vinegar too, and he wasn't afraid to look at the shadow side of life and to call us on when our shadow stuff was sticking out all over. We weren't noticing it because we thought we were such wonderful people practicing the Dharma, And I think it was very kind of him to point that out, and that I really appreciate that part of his personality and his teaching. So I want to read a little bit to end, and then we can have a discussion if you want. I'd like to read a little bit from his book. You have to say something about what he says about this death and inseparability. People have a preconception that when you become a Zen priest, you have to die peacefully, preferably in a sitting position. But I don't think there's any particular pattern to how you should die. You may have ideas about how to die or about what a happy death is, but when you're actually faced with death, there are no guarantees about what will happen. When you face death, there's no space to look at death as an object. You are right there. Even in the face of death, you have to understand how to live from moment to moment. Maybe especially then. Those who are about to die experience many complicated emotions, feelings of despair, sentimentality, and anger. This is very natural. But finally, they reach a stage where they completely give up. They realize that there's no solution and there's nothing to grasp. Within the realm of resignation, their consciousness still vibrates minutely. The Buddhist way of understanding the world makes it clear that it's not necessary to have a conceptual understanding about life and death. One person struggles and screams in the last moment, another prays to God. One person chants the name of Buddha, another expresses anger and hatred. That's fine. Whatever way a person dies is fine. The point is, however we view death, when we face it, we must be present right there in the middle of the vast universe, which is completely beyond our speculations of good or bad or right or wrong. Our life is nothing but an endless stream, a dynamic flow of energy. All we have to do is just be there in the last moment. That's all we have to do. Or all we have to do is be there for someone we love. I have a handout I'm going to pass around. A handout. It's Being with Dying, and it gives some kind of good basic information about how you can be with others who are experiencing their last moments or their last days or their last months in a way that's helpful. There's some websites on there that you can check out. One of those is the Meta Institute. That's a wonderful website. The Zen Hospice Project and the Rigpa Foundation. The Rigpa Foundation is a Tibetan Buddhist death and dying organization. And Zen Hospice Project was started out at San Francisco Zen Center. And Meta Institute is the former director of Zen Hospice Project, his website. So if you're interested in going deeper yourself in the practice of being there for your loved ones in a way that's helpful, there's resources you can look into. And that's about all I have to say. If you are wanting to discuss any of this or any of what's on the handout, I don't know if there's time. Susan, is there time for us to do that? Okay.
So the gorgeous son ever said anything about euthanasia?
I never heard anything like that, Arnie, from him. You did? Oh, Andrea's going to speak to that.
I asked a question kind of along those lines once. My father-in-law was living in my home with my family, and he was dying of originally colon cancer, but, you know, complications of that. Mm-hmm. We used to have question and answer Wednesday night, student, or some night we would come and we would have tea and it would be like an open forum and you could ask a question.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, my father-in-law's doctors were saying, you should just let him go. It's not really euthanasia, but it's, you know, it's getting a little bit close to that. But rather than intervene in any way, you should just let him go. And so I asked about that. And Katagiri was very definitive. In fact, Tomoe-san was here at that time, too. And they were both like, no, that's not okay.
Mm.
You just let life play itself out, basically.
Mm. Okay,
yeah, I think that would be the traditional Buddhist view. I mean, I think in palliative care and in the hospice movement, it's really up to the goal is to discern what the patient would want, you know. And family members and loved ones are encouraged to find that out before the person is unable to communicate. And if they are already unable to communicate, then to someone in the family who knows them well, to think, you know, what would Aunt Dorothy want here? You know, for the loved ones to think into that.
Right, I want my clarification on what you just said, because I wasn't clear. What was Katagiri saying no to?
Basically, I understood him to say every moment of life is precious.
So to let someone just go is wrong? Is that what he was saying?
Well, I guess, what do you mean by letting them go? You know, like it was...
Well, I was confused by that.
Yeah, I guess you get into a bit of a fuzzy territory with life support versus natural processes taking their course. And you do have to make a lot of decisions at that point. But I don't think that we didn't really get into the details of what letting him go would mean. But I used the word letting him go because that was what the doctors were saying to the family, was not to do anything anymore. But we did continue to do some things within our judgment of what was appropriate to do. And what I saw in him, and I also saw in my mother, where I faced similar questions as well, was there were a lot of transformations that happened to people as they approached death. And some of them are really beautiful to see. Things that people change in ways you could never imagine as death approaches. In those cases, both of those people, my father-in-law and my mother, became very grateful people, starting to express their gratitude to people around them in ways that they had never done before. And I think it's just, you never know what's going to happen, and every moment is a precious thing, so you can't, in your own limited human mind, you really don't know what the right thing is. But you still, sometimes you have to make a decision anyway. You just have to do the best you can. But that...
Yeah. No, I was just wondering if he had said no to just letting nature take its course. Was he in favor of life support? Because that was
saying no.
Okay, that's what I was not clear.
I don't think what he meant was something that specific.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah. Right.
I think it was more general, holding up that life is precious. And let's not lose sight of that.
Not to turn away from it.
Right. Not to actively seek to do something specific to end their life, or to forget anywhere along the path that every moment of life is precious. And as a representative of Buddhism, the religion which he was, he had to make that clear, that you know that life is precious is a high value. One of the things you learn in palliative care and in chaplaincy is that families don't always know is that when at the end of life, when food and water are finally withdrawn, or the patient either says no more, or the family, on the advice of the medical staff, says that's fine, you can stop that now. So people don't always realize that that it's very stressful to the body to take food and drink towards the end. It makes the dying process harder physically, and there are some states of consciousness and actual bliss that are available to the person in the dying process that are connected with the removal of food and drink. And I think that when people find that out, it gives them, you know, a little bit more information to make a decision with. They don't realize that there are all these conflicts, you know, with holding food from mom and dad. That's not kind. That's, you know. But when they find out that, you know, for people, nurses, palliative care nurses and hospice nurses know, they have a pretty good idea of how close this person is getting to death, and at that point or at those points, then it's really a gift. Not to continue to make the body cope with food and drink. So.
I had a phone call in the middle of the night tonight about life support with my mother. She was old and she had a lot of medical problems, but you didn't really know, you know, what would the end be. She had a directive, I don't know what you call them, but a health care directive was on file to not do
CPR.
Yeah, right, in her home. But then she got taken to the hospital and they called me like 2 in the morning and said what was going on, should we put her on life support or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're waking up in the middle of the night and you have to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have all the information. I was here, she was in Boston, you know. Mm-hmm. What do you do? That was just a real question.
What did you do?
I asked the doctor or whoever it was calling a lot of questions. What were the, you know, what would happen this way, what would happen that way, and I finally said to put her on life support.
Okay.
Because they had a drug that they hadn't had time to work or something like that. And she was gasping for breath, and finally I said, what would she like to do? And he said, I think she would like to go. Or something like that. It was a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember it clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But I did say yes to disregard the directive and put her on life support. And what happened after that was the drug did make a difference, and she did stay alive for a little bit longer. And in the end, she died from a blood clot situation, but she died very peacefully. If she had died that way, she would have died, you know, gasping for breath, panicked, and she died very faithful. So, you know, I'm not saying there's one right or not, but it's good to think about it ahead of time to know what you would do.
Yeah, there's a foundation called the Five Wishes Foundation. You can also look them up online, and they have forms that you can order that go into more detail than some of the living wills or the healthcare directives about what does this person want towards the end, even what they want in a memorial service. And it's really recommended to, you know, to think about those things and to share them with close family members and people that will be involved. It's a great thing to do.
I think these questions just highlight the fact, too, that it's important to remember that these are questions that are unique to our lifetime, that never before in the history of humanity have we been able to extend life like this. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, good to have compassion for yourself and for
mm-hmm.
everybody else in the situation, because we're all just kind of figuring it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're groping in the dark a lot. And
you shouldn't feel guilty. You know, I've seen some people make decisions and then later feel like, oh, I should have made a different decision. And you just can't do that. You have to just do the best you can.
I remember when people would ask Katagiri these sort of hard and fast questions like, what, is the Buddhist, you know, what's the teaching on this and what's the teaching on that? And so often he would give the teaching and then he would say, but it's case by case, case by case. It's always case by case. And it always comes back to us and doing the best we can under hard circumstances sometimes.
Another comment?
Yeah.
I don't see anywhere on here, and I wonder if it is in any of this material or if you've come across the idea that it's important to express to a dying person that he or she is not alone. Mm-hmm. For me, I think this would be one of the most prominent feelings
mm-hmm.
of a person who's dying, to feel, because it's something that that person is facing completely, absolutely, utterly alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if that is... I'm a little surprised not to see it here.
Yeah, I haven't come across it, but I think that when you're there physically for them,
mm-hmm.
and you say the other things that... gifts and even telling stories and about the specific things they did that were so wonderful, your memories and all that kind of thing is really great. And no, I haven't seen that. And this is a real incomplete list that I pulled different things and put together. Those four things to say are from palliative care best practices. And I know that Frank Ostrowski is a high consciousness Zen Hospice Project, now the Meta Institute Director. He has five precepts for being with the dying that I could not find to bring to you. Okay, time to stop. Oh, after Ben, yeah. Okay, Ben.
Be kind.
Mm.
That bastard.
Thank you.
He knows how I feel. I'm an open book. But, you know, really, I'm looking at this and, you know, seeing that everything is all included. There wouldn't be anything wrong with just saying, I love you and thank you every day.
Absolutely not. Nothing wrong. It's recommended.